So our next subject is value, utility, and price. And I'll talk certainly about all of these things. So the point of the lecture will be to give you an introduction into Austrian price theory. The importance of the subject is clear in that prices are the heart of the market economy. So if there's one thing characteristic of a market economy, it's the fact that there are prices being paid and received. It's precisely this fact that makes a market economy aesthetically and or morally unacceptable for certain sensitive souls, in particular the labor market, right? And, always, there's still some people left with the then snap and say, well, labor is not a commodity. Well, sorry. I mean, the price is being paid for labor performed. And as soon as such an exchange takes place, we have a price. So there is certainly a commodity character, or certainly in some respects, and at least labor must be similar to tomatoes and oranges and so on, whereas it's certainly not in all respects, but that's a different matter. So prices are certainly the heart of economic of the market economy, and price theory then is at the heart of economic theory. Prices have traditionally been explained. So what is the cause of prices? And the Austrians are famous for the approach, as they say, they belong to the marginal utility or marginal value schools, right? So they explain market prices in terms of a more general, of an underlying reality that they call value. Right? So value then is the cause of price. And within the neoclassical camp, the structure of the argument is the same. Here we would say that utility is the cause underlying prices. Now, this is not something that started only in the 1870s with what is called the marginalist revolution, right? Menger, Jevons, and Walras. It goes back much further in time. Actually, so the insight that market prices or the value of things, the market price of things, might have something to do with utility, right, or subjective value of the market participants. That was already present in the Middle Ages. Right? You find, for example, in the work of Thomas Aquinas, various other scholastics. Right? It survived throughout the 16th and 17th century in the works of the late scholastics, right? In particular in the works of what has been called the School of Salamanca. And here some writers of this school actually identified the principle of marginal valuation, right? So they anticipated the marginalist revolution that then set in the 1870s. The reason why such a revolution was necessary was because there was no continuity from the School of Salamanca down to Karl Menger, Jevons, and Walras in 1870. But there was something in between, and the something in between is called the school of classical economists. Classical economists. Or classical economics. So the classical economists, who were they? In particular, Adam Smith, Malthus, David Ricardo, Jean-Baptiste Say, okay? And the classical economists, they deviated from this approach to explain prices in terms of an underlying, of their utility for human beings, in arguing that market prices result from the cost of production, okay? So the fact, for example, that this pen might sell for 10 coronas here in Denmark derives or is explained by the fact that it costs, well, 10 coronas minus profit to produce the pen. Okay, so that's the reason. It cannot be sold for less because then the entrepreneur would make a loss. It will not be sold for more because then competition would set in and drive down the price toward this price of 10 coronas. Okay, so that was the argument of the classical economists. The main problem in this explanation, in the cost of production explanation, is circularity. Okay, so if it's really the cost of production that explain the price of the pen, well, where do these costs of production come from? Okay, where does the value, so may I say, the cost of production for this is I have to pay so and so many people, workers to produce the pens, materials needed to produce the pen. But then the question is, of course, well, how are the prices that I pay to these guys in turn determined? Okay, how are the prices that I pay for the plastic and for the color and so on that I use to make the pen, how are these determined? How are the prices for the labor determined and so on? So you move back ever more, and ultimately you start explaining one thing in terms of another thing, and you end up with a circular explanation. That's the big problem in the cost of production approach. So even the classical economists, and in particular Jean-Baptiste Say, never abandoned the notion, but David Ricardo as well, that the ultimate foundation for prices is to be found in utility, that is, in the contribution that the object under consideration makes to human welfare. But they could not explain how this link would work out. And in particular, they could not do this because believed that there was a paradox, what has been later on called the classical paradox of value. It can be stated very quickly in the following way. I mean, utility cannot be the explanation for market prices because there are certain objects that have a very high utility for human life, such as water, that command a very low price. Without water, we could not survive, so water is vitally important for human life. But we pay very, very low prices for water, and usually we don't pay prices for water at all. In many areas of the world, we still pay no prices for water at all. On the other hand, there are objects like diamonds, which have certainly a utility, but a utility that, as compared to water, is not very high. And still, it is the case that we pay very high prices for diamonds. A tiny diamond, you have to work a year or two to buy it on the market. So this was the classical paradox of value, also sometimes called the diamond-water paradox, right? Because, in fact, these two examples that I've used are the most widely used examples to illustrate the paradox. Now, the solution to this paradox is to be found in the principle of marginal value. And here the emphasis is on marginal. And this brings us then to Menger's approach, which in this respect, as far as marginality is concerned, the principle of marginal price determination, has the same structural features as the theories of Jevons and Varaz. So what Menger said, same observation that Jevons made, was that we get the paradox of value because we reason in terms of classes, of entire classes of goods. Okay. You say water in general has a higher utility than diamonds in general. And as a consequence, we get the paradox because the price of water is much lower than the price of diamonds. But in real-world situations, in the very situations in which market prices come to be established, right? You go into a shop and so on, you never go to a supermarket and say, well, I want to buy all the water in the world. Right? Or I never go to a jeweler and say, well, give me all the diamonds in the world. Apart from the question that he could not sell you all the diamonds because he doesn't own all the diamonds in the world. And so what we always do is we buy and sell concrete units, concrete quantities, limited quantities of the overall supply. And the prices are in fact determined in the light of these individual partial units of the overall supply. And so it comes that certain individual units might have a very low value because our needs are already satisfied by the existing supply. So one way to illustrate this, and this is the way it is usually done in economics classes, is that we say we have here a supply, we have a quantity, and here we have the utility. And this utility is decreasing with the supply. Okay, so this would be the way Jevons and Varaz have done this. And what we find in Austrian economics is something very similar, namely that we say every unit of a good serves individual or concrete needs. That is, for example, if I have a supply of 10 fish, third fish, here we have the 10th fish, then every single unit of the supply will be accorded to satisfy an individual concrete need. So the most important use that I might have for a fish is to stay alive, right? So I will eat the fish, eat myself, eat the fish myself, right? Eat the fish myself to stay alive. If I were an altruist, I would say, have my wife eat a fish to stay alive. Well, okay, so let's be realistic. And then the second is, have my wife eat a fish. Eat a fish. And so on, right? And the third fish is for the children, and the fourth for the grandparents, and the fifth might be for the neighbors, the sixth is for a charitable organization, and then number seven is sold on the market. Number eight is a fish that I might eat just for pleasure. Number nine would be a fish that I will eat just to stuff myself, right? And number 10 will be a fish that I give my kids to eat for pleasure, and so on, right? So we have different uses of the concrete units, right? And the point is that in making my choices, I select the most important uses that I can make of the object under consideration, right? So if I have just one fish, I will allocate this fish to the most important use. If I have two fish, I will allocate it to the two most important uses. And this always means that there are various other uses that will not be supplied with. Okay. So it follows then that by the very nature of this principle, that every increase of the supply of a homogeneous good that I might have will lead to less important needs being satisfied. Okay. Now we can express this in a curve such as this, or rather, right? We would have discrete and concrete dots, right? No continuous thing. Well, in the case of fish, I might subdivide it and so on. Okay. If you're a good fish cutter. So we have a very similar principle here, right? But there's one important difference as compared to Jevons and Varaz, and that's the difference that we need to talk about now. Namely, what Jevons and Varaz stress here is this reality of utility. That is, that they say an increase in the quantity of a good consumed will lead to a lesser satisfaction. Okay, and this satisfaction is conceived to be something psychological. Okay, I'm very thirsty. I drink the first beer. I'm satisfied. I'm happy. I drink the second beer. I'm a little less satisfied. I drink the 17th beer. I'm completely drunk. And so we have something like this, right? Quantity increases, and then at some point, the utility, that is the satisfaction, the psychological feeling of wellness and so on that we derive from it, becomes negative. Right? Now, that's very different from this, right? Because what we here have is a psychological account of the phenomenon of marginal utility or marginal value, whereas here we have a praxeological account. Right? Here the point of the argument is to say, because of by the very nature of things being liable to be subdivided in discrete units, every increase in the quantity will lead to the satisfaction of a want that is less important than the ones that have been satisfied so far. What's the demonstration or what is the proof of this? Well, the proof of this is that the very fact that I choose to allocate the two goods to these two users, eat the fish myself and then have my wife eat a fish, proves that they are the most important users. Right? I prove it through action. It's a demonstrated preference, if you wish. Okay? And by the very fact, I prove that all these other users are less important than the ones that I have selected. So we have here a principle at work that Rothbard has called the principle of demonstrated preference. And we have a praxeological law. Whereas here in the Jevons-Warraz account, we have a psychological law. Now what is this just, are these not just different ways of saying the same thing? Well, there are distinct advantages to the praxeological approach. The first one is that, I mean, it is realistic. It is realistic that in any given situation we make choices. These choices are always taking place in a certain context. And in making choices and preferring certain things, we at the same time renounce to other things. Okay? In selecting these two uses of my fish supply, I automatically renounce to all other alternatives that I could have chosen instead. Right? And that is the basis for the principle of diminishing marginal value. In the psychological account, the thing is much less clear. In fact, we have here two main problems. The first one is there is no unit of one satisfaction that could be generalized. For different commodities, certainly, but even within one class of commodities, right? Say the pleasure that I derive from drinking beer is very different from the pleasure that I derive from, let's say, dance lessons, right? Or from the pleasure of listening to piano concerts, or of eating a piece of bread, right? So how are we to say, well, this is the same unit of utility? Well, what's the empirical basis for making such an assertion? There is none. Okay. So in economic textbooks, sometimes we still have the use of the word util, right? So it's a basic unit of utility. But this util is completely fictitious. It's not something that can be really observed. Right? And the second problem that we have in the psychological account is that the story is not always as clear-cut as this. There might be cases in which the pleasure that I derive from a good actually increases with increased consumption. For example, I might at first be offended by a certain type of music, AC/DC, Right? And then more I get to listen and find some pleasure. Maybe it's not very high, but might be higher than zero. But so the point is that as soon as we have something like this, right, we could no longer say that there is a strict general law that the marginal utility always decreases with an increasing quantity. We get something completely different, right? It's a completely different result, which affects our price theory. Whereas from the praxeological point of view, we always have diminishing marginal value as the quantity increases. Okay. So why did Jevons and Varaz choose the psychological account? There are various speculations about this. I think the most plausible explanation is that this account lends itself much more easily to mathematical formalizing. And that is for the following reason. If you have this account, then you have value or utility is by and large is a two-sided relationship. Right? We have a man, now in the general sense, right, men and women, and we have his satisfaction. And we have the quantity of a good. Right? And if we assume that the dimension of the satisfaction is the same for one man as far as all goods are concerned, so that there is a basic util unit underlying any satisfaction that I might derive from piano concerts and so on, attending lectures and so on, all this is basically a same unit of satisfaction, then I get a common denominator for all these goods. Okay, get a common denominator for all these goods, and I can write a nice equation that gives me the equilibrium condition, that is the condition that should hold in the situation that is optimal for my decision making, namely that the price of good, the relationship between the price for good one and the utility that I derive from good one is the same as the relationship between the price that I pay for good two and the price, the utility that I derive from good two, and is the same as the utility that I derive from good three and the price that I pay for it, and so on and so on. Right? Graphically, we can express this in the following way. It's the so-called second law of Gossen. We have here the utility of 1, utility 2, utility 3, and here we have the quantity of 1, quantity 2, quantity 3. And now we might have different utility curves here, so. Right? And in equilibrium, the marginal utility that I derive from any good should be exactly the same as the marginal utility that I derive from any other good. Right? So let's say if this is my budget line, then I should consume in equilibrium this quantity of good 1 and this quantity of good 2 and this quantity of good 3. Right? If I consumed a greater quantity of good 1, this means because things are scarce that I could consume only a lesser quantity of any of the other goods, but this would mean that my marginal utility is lower for this good, right, than the marginal utility that I would derive from any other of the other goods, so I would not be in equilibrium. I would have excessive consumption of 1 and deficient consumption of some of the other goods. So in order to equalize the marginal utilities and therefore maximize overall utility, I have to take care that the marginal utilities are the same for all goods. Now, this is all very nice. You can give a nice graphical presentation, and we can formulate the equilibrium condition in an equation, which makes very sophisticated, right, and scientific. But the problem is, as I've said, that it's based on a fictitious stipulation. If we make the stipulation, without this stipulation, we could not draw up these all graphs. We could not draw up this equation. As soon as we admit that these might be different units here, completely incomparable units, right, the equation no longer holds. Right? So that's my hypothesis then, that the reason why Jevons and Walras, who certainly had an interest in applying mathematics to social phenomena, because that was the way they conceived the progress of science to be, they made this fictitious stipulation because it alone helped them to do what they wanted to do, namely apply mathematics for the description of social phenomena. Now, things are very different in the Mengerian approach. What Menger does, so we have not these two-sided relationship, man's satisfaction and the quantity of a good. This homogeneous blob, man's satisfaction, all the same. So what we have in Menger is, in fact, a trilateral relationship. We have man, we have alternative one, and we have alternative two. Both alternatives are related to ends that the acting person pursues, but he has to make up his mind between them. He can choose either one or the other one. Now, so this way of conceiving of value, right? The value is in fact the relationship between the choice alternatives for a given individual in a specific historical concrete context. Okay, that is what value is. It's not a unit, it's not a substance, a fictitious substance. It is a relationship between value choice alternatives, and it necessarily, therefore, varies from one context to another. Right? So it makes no sense to assume that it could be given a common basic unit. There is no such thing. Rather, it varies really from context to context. It cannot be therefore expressed in such an equation, at least not in this equation, which is the foundation of modern, until the present day, neoclassical price theory. So, let me then, after having explained these differences between Menger's approach and Jevons and Walras's approach, let me emphasize some things in more detail. So Menger, in his value theory, stresses first of all that we need to make fundamentally the distinction between economic goods and goods in general. Right? Value, the phenomenon that we need to explain prices, applies only, can exist only in the case of economic goods. Right? A good in general would be, for example, sunshine. Right? Helps things to grow, makes human beings happy, and so on, but it is not an economic good. Why is this? Essentially because sunshine cannot be controlled, right? Cannot be owned by human beings. So it cannot be a means for human action. Right? So we have here one condition for a thing having value, namely it must be liable to be in private property. Then another good, in general, would be, but not an economic good, would be air. Right? The air that we breathe, oxygen and so on, is certainly vitally important for human life, but it's not an economic good in most situations. For example, here in this room, there's enough breathing oxygen available, right? that does not need to be economized. We don't need to act on behalf of air. Things are completely different if you are in a submarine, 100 meters below the sea level and so on, and your oxygen supply is running out. Right? Then you have a little problem, and oxygen becomes a scarce good. So we have here the relationship between needs and available supplies. And in the case of an economic goods, there are always more users or more needs that we can conceive of than the supply of the available supply of the good would help us to satisfy. Right? So then we have an economic good. And then what we also would need is perception of this of the existence of the situation. That is, we might have certain goods that are in fact true goods and economic goods, but because we don't perceive them to be such, well, there are no economic goods at all. For example, take the case of uranium. Right? Before the discovery of of nuclear power technology, right? There were no uses available for uranium. Right? People knew it existed, but no uses were available for it. Right? So the available supply surpassed any uses that could be made of it, so it was not even a good. Right? After the discovery of this new technology, suddenly the possible uses for it exceeded the available supply, and that was because suddenly people perceived this physical object, uranium, as an economic good, as a good. So we need to have perception of the reality as one constitutive part, a central characteristic of an economic good. And so one of the things that Karl Menger then did in his Principles of Economics was to state these conditions, explained very clearly. So we have the distinction between economic goods and goods, and then economic goods can have value only if they are perceived and if they can be privately owned, that is, if they can be controlled by individuals. And then he explained that we have this regularity that I discussed before, that is, we have the praxeological derivation of the law of diminishing marginal value. Which is, as I've said, a praxeological law. Okay, so how do we get from there to the explanation of market prices? That was, after all, our initial purpose. Therefore, we became interested in value theory and so on. And the way to do this deduction is to start with a simple case. Let's return to our example that we had Paul and Peter and the apple-pear exchange. So we observe Paul is giving his apple to Peter, and Peter is giving his pear to Paul. What is taking place here, and how far does our value theory help us account for this observation? Well, what we would say in this case is that Paul has a value scale. That is, for Paul, in the given context, the two goods under consideration stand in a value relationship. He would say that the apple is more important than the pear. Now, that's a writing convention. If you write two objects below one another, above one another, we mean that the higher object has a higher value. So the apple for Paul, or sorry, the pear for Paul, has a higher value than the apple. And the apple for Peter has a higher value than the pear. And then there's another writing convention, is that we say, well, Paul, he has the apple, he does not have the pear, so we put the pear into brackets. And Peter has the pear, he does not have the apple, so we put the apple into brackets. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if we have such a situation, so that is the condition that must be given for a market price to exchange. Right? So two conditions, we have private property, right? Of course, in the two objects exchanged. And we have inverse value scales. Right? This is an inverse ranking of the goods under consideration. Right? Both Paul and Peter value apple and pear, but their valuations are exactly the opposite. For Paul, the pear is more important than the apple, and for Peter, the apple is more important than the pear. So there can be a market exchange, and there will be a market exchange if both of them perceive the situation. Right? And how does this come about, this perception? Well, usually, for example, if they show up at a marketplace or they just ask one another, hey, Paul, do you want to give me your apple? And then there's an answer, yes or no, and then you have a perception of a reality. Right? You say, yes, give me your pear. And so we have this market exchange coming about. Now, what is the general lesson that we can derive from this? Well, the lesson that we derive from this here is that market prices are based always on not on value equality, right? We do not exchange things that are of equal value, but things that have different value. And these values, the value differences, must, on top of this, be inverse for the two market participants. Okay. Now that is important if we keep in mind that from Aristotle to Karl Marx and even beyond Karl Marx, there have always been more or less smart thinkers who held that value was ultimately an expression of equality. Right? The fact that things are being exchanged on the market demonstrates their equality from the point of view of the acting person. Right? So even somebody like Jean-Baptiste Say, he still held this. And even if you read him sometimes today by my good friend Pascal Salin in France, he still would say that market exchanges somehow express value equality. He does this, of course, in a metaphorical sense, but it lends itself to this confusion. So the point is, market exchanges always come about because there are differences in value and differences in valuations. Okay, now we have a little time to go into the details of pricing. So here we have a market price emerging on the market, and the market price is the relationship between the apple and the pear. One apple is again exchanged against one pear, or one pear against one apple. We can write this in the following way. That is the market price. Okay. Now, these situations in which consumer goods are exchanged against one another are called barter exchanges, and barter exchanges are not very important empirically. Right? All civilizations that we know, and I say all civilizations that we know of historically, have been monetary economies. Right? Even if we go back to the earliest records that we have, there is no civilization that did not use money. So we have the use of money in exchanges. And, well, let's use this for our example here and set up a value scale for an individual that, say, let's own fish, right? And for this individual under consideration, let's say he has a stock of 10 fish. Now, the totality of these 10 fish is for him more important than the totality of total supply of 9 fish, okay? And the total supply of 9 fish is more important than the total supply of 8 fish, of 7 fish, of 6 fish, 5, and so on, until 1 fish. And the 1 fish that he has is more important to him than the second fish that he could acquire but has not yet, and more important than the third fish that he could acquire but has not yet, and so on. Right? So we have a value scale that holds true, mutatis mutandis, for every single good. Okay. Now, if we have a market exchange, we need to plug in some other good that could be exchanged for the fish into this value scale. And let's say here, so we take 6 coronas, I say 100 coronas. What's the abbreviation for coronas? Is this KR? KR. 100 coronas. Okay, so this object, right, the individual quantity of 100 coronas is for this individual, let's say that's Paul, is for Paul, 100 coronas that he does not have is for him more important than 6 fish and 5 fish and so on and so on and so on, but less important than the total supply of 7 fish, 8 fish, 9 fish, 10 fish, and so on. Okay. Now Paul is going to deal with Peter on the market, and for Peter is of course the same thing. Peter has a value scale that is as follows: 10 fish, which he does not have, is more important than 9 fish, is more important than 8 fish, seven fish, six fish, 5 fish, 4, and so on, so on, so on. And he does not own fish, but he wants to buy fish. But he does have coronas, so he has a banknote, 100 coronas, and let's say the 100 coronas were ranking here in his value scale. Now the question is, under these conditions, would there be a market exchange, right, between the two market participants, Paul and Peter? And the answer is, there would be no exchange, right? Because for Peter, in order to incite him to give up his 100 coronas, one would have to offer him at least 9 fish or 10 fish and so on, right? But Paul, who is a fish owner, will not give him this amount of fish for 100 corona bill, because anything bigger than anything upward from 7 fish is more important to him than the 100 coronas. Okay, so an exchange, a market exchange, will only take place if the value scales are somewhat different. For example, if we have the 100 coronas here, right? In this case, Peter would give up his 100 coronas to obtain 6 fish, and Paul would, in fact, give up 6 fish to obtain the ticket of 100 coronas. Okay, so in this case, then, we would have a market exchange that results from these value scales. And it would in fact be, now accidentally, because of my example, would be exactly determined. So the market price that would obtain on the market is 100 coronas for 6 fish. Okay. Now we can construe other examples that might be empirically also relevant in other cases. For example, Peter's value scale might be such that the 100 coronas rank here. So in this case, there are three different market prices that could be established. The 100 coronas could be exchanged against 6 fish, against 5 fish, or against 4 fish. Right? Our analysis of this process does not allow us to give the concrete determination. Right? So here, other particular circumstances would come into play, like psychology and so on, about which we cannot say anything. Right? We have no theory that would explain us the concrete price that would emerge under such situations, so we help ourselves with an intellectual shortcut. We say then that the concrete price would be determined by the bargaining abilities of the two individuals, right? Which is an intellectual shortcut because we have not explained anything, right? We say, okay, the price will be determined by something that we don't know anything about, and we call this something bargaining abilities, okay. But still, the theory is not valueless, even in this case, because we have upper and lower boundaries within which the price must necessarily be established. And about these boundaries or limits of the pricing process, our theory informs us. Right? So the theory tells us that there will be a maximum price and a minimum price above which and below which the price cannot go or fall. Okay. Now the whole picture gets even more involved and complicated if we bring in additional buyers and sellers. Okay, and I won't do this now because already I have problems drawing up the value scales for two individuals here, but to make the long story short, the result is that as you bring ever more people into the picture, there are two modifications. One is that we have something like arbitrage. Right? We might imagine two other individuals, Mary and Elizabeth, exchanging. And let's say their value scales were such that the price would be at 100 coronas for 9 fish or for 10 fish, okay? So then we would have two different prices, and clearly this cannot be in the interest of Peter, who is the corona owner, to pay 100 coronas to get a comparatively shabby small amount of fish from his partner Paul, but he would rather go to one of the girls and get for 100 coronas, get a higher price. So he would bid down the price that is paid on the female market, right? And as a consequence, there would be an overall equilibrium price emerge for the total market. Now the second observation here is that the more market participants we bring into the picture, the more people we bring into the picture, the more finely determined will the price be. Right? The more people they are involved, the more exactly we can, with the mere help of our economic analysis, determine what the market price will be. And then irrespective of the number of market participants, the theory always tells us about boundaries. It tells us about upper limits and lower limits. And Austrians call these upper limits and lower limits. They say that these limits are determined by the so-called marginal buyers and sellers. Okay, by the upper limit is determined by the buyer who is still ready to pay this high price. The lower limit is determined by the seller who is still ready to sell at this low price. Okay, so here we have then again, right? We have a realistic description of the pricing process. We don't rely on fictitious postulates. Right? The argument relies on the mere fact that we do make choices, Right? That in making choices, we are setting aside, we are preferring things and setting other things aside. So there's a value ranking, a value scale between the different choice alternatives. Right? And then this concerns not only individual action outside of a social context, but it also concerns human action within a social context, and in particular in a market context. In a market context, then we have market prices emerging if the valuations are inverse. Right? And we have a determination, a more or less fine determination of the concrete market price, not in the way that we could fix a particular point at which the price has to be established, but in that we can fix boundaries. And the boundaries are more or less narrow. Right? We know that the boundaries are more or less narrow, the more market participants come into play. Right? They get ever more narrow, the more market participants come into play. Okay, I'll leave it at this, and we'll give you a few minutes for questions. Not necessarily. For example, let's imagine here we could construe an example in which the the boundaries are extremely wide. Let's say the 100 coronas would be here. Okay, then the price could be anything between 9 and 4. Now let's assume this guy is a very good bargainer. So he gets 9 fish for his 100 coronas. Okay. Then, in order to answer your question, I need to make the other assumption. This guy is a very good bargainer, so in order to get the 100 coronas, he just pays 4 fish. Okay. Now, it might be, if other market participants come into play, that the price will actually increase. Right? Let's say there's a second buyer that comes into play, let's say Mary. And Mary, so he has all this same value scale, and her 100 coronas would be here. So she would be ready to pay any price in between, ready to buy 400 coronas between 6 and 9 fish. Okay? So that means that the price in this case would go up as a consequence of the appearance of this additional market participant. It would not stay as low. No, I mean, the point of the theory is not to say, well, market prices will go up or down. The point of the theory is not to say, well, on the free market, the prices will always be low. Right? What the theory says is that the more market participants you have, the finer you have, the more concrete is the determination of the price, the more exactly can we say where the price will be. Okay? If you have just two market participants, the possible price or the price, the spread within which the price can be established can be very, very large. The more market participants you have, the more narrow the limits become. Does not necessarily mean that the limits will become smaller, okay, from the point of view of the original two market participants that we considered.
Are there any fundamental insights in how the market economy or prices work that you gain from the praxeological approach that you cannot derive from the neoclassical?
Well, I would say only the praxeological approach gives you a scientific explanation of the whole pricing process. And otherwise, as far as these other similarities, there are other similarities that exist. Right? If you say the supply increases, and there's a tendency for the price to decrease as well. Right? So there is certainly a common point. Right? So there are common conclusions, but right, only the Austrians have given a correct.
So you claim that the methodology is superior, but the results are the same?
You arrive at the same conclusions with different arguments. Right? And of course, the point in science is always to give the right reasons. Right? If you don't have the right reasons, you can, by chance, come up with the right conclusion. Right? I can say, well, I go and swim in the Öresund, and I make this movement. Right? And the reason why I swim is because doing this, I'm giving signs to the angels living in the sea. And they come up and lift me up. So I might say, okay, the conclusion is the same, the conclusion that we would base on what we know about fluids and so on, right? But so the result is the same, but the explanation is very different. Another question? Okay, we'll leave it here. You can always come in the pauses and ask me more, and I'll go on explaining. I'm yours during the weekend, right? You can bombard me with your questions, and as long as I'm here, I'm answering questions. I'll leave then, and then I'm gone away. I won't take telephone calls. Thank you.